So talked yesterday about what are the primary functions of a microkernel in some abstract sense. And what I want to try to do today is switch gears a little bit and talk about how those functions are actually captured from the perspective of the interface that an application sees. So one of the things that you'll find is a very common thread in microkernel design is the interfaces that these microkernels implement are very, very thin interfaces. Very little functionality, but I think it's not that there's little functionality, but that functionality is packaged very artfully. Certainly there's little functionality as compared to a Unix kernel. You can build Unix comparable functionality, but it's not the microkernel's job alone to provide it. The one way to think about a microkernel is it provides, and I said essentially this yesterday, it provides the communication substrate and the encapsulation and protection substrate for the rest of your system. And if those are the basic functions, you don't need 350 system calls. What I want to try to approximately walk through today is how the L4 kernel deals with these issues as best I understand it. And I should caution you that I don't fully understand it. Having said that, I should also add, I've spent a lot of time talking to people in the L4 community, and there are places where the L4 community doesn't agree about what the answers are. So it's hard to understand. But I think the basics are pretty clear. L4 system has something on the order of 7 to 11 system calls, depending on who you ask and which generation of the system you look at. Of those, frankly, all but one are pretty much uninteresting. Right? They're trivial operations in the sense of, here's a process, move it to the running state, or something about that level of complexity. Okay. From an architectural perspective, if you look at the L4 system, the foundational idea is in two places that are intimately related. So it's in IPC and it's in a particular operation that they call MAC. And more specifically, there's a trio of operations, MAP, UNMAP, and GRANT. UNMAP is one of those other system calls, and actually that one's not trivial. I want to focus my attention on MAP and GRANT today, and I'll explain what UNMAP does. So here's the idea. If I look at the L4 kernel, there is a vector in the kernel of, at least in the historical L4 kernel, of what they call tasks. And just to make terminological nightmares really confusing, these data structures, if you look at the L4 literature, are referred to as TCBs for task control blocks. Every place else you see the term TCB will mean trusted dependency base. Horrible choice. Often terms selected in isolation have this property that they collide with something you wish they didn't collide with. And the rationale for this is in other systems, this data structure would have been called a process, and process control block is in fact common terminology, so that was how they got it. An IPC, right, is a transfer of control from one task to a second task, and as part of that transfer of control, there's a message payload that gets sent. There's a data motion. And the data motion, and I'm going to simplify this slightly, I want to come back to some sugaring features that we would add on top of this, that in fact L4 does add and other systems add in different forms. I want to give you sort of the basic idea. The basic payload of an IPC is a string S, and the sugar I'm not going to talk about today is something called scatter data. And a, let me be careful, an indirect string, okay, and a vector of up to k words. I don't remember what k is, it's some sizable number. And maybe I shouldn't reuse J, huh? Up to n methods. Okay, so the registers part here, I should say, is not necessarily hardware. These words are not necessarily hardware registers. If you look at the current definitions of the L4 specification, you'll see that they have a notion of something called, I don't remember, they may have called it a virtual register or something like that. So the idea is that the software architecture defines K virtual registers associated with every task. Okay. And the first so many of those are actually in hardware registers. How many depends on what architecture you're on. So you can transfer K on any architecture, but how many of those will end up in hardware registers depends on which machine you're on. So in addition to the task control block, every task has something that they call a UTCB, user component of the task control block. And sometimes in email, you'll see them distinguish these as the UTCB and the KTCB for kernel TCB. Now what's the UTCB? Well, the UTCB, here's the idea. The application visible register set, it's application state. The application is intrinsically entitled to change it. That's what it means to execute in some sense. So that's part of what it means. Now, if you buy that, then from the standpoint of protection, it would be perfectly okay to say, hey, when I enter the kernel and I save the registers, the register state, anything non-privileged, right? There's some privileged stuff and we're going to have to be careful about it. The non-privileged state, it would be perfectly okay to save it to a data structure that was directly accessible by user mode code. So I could have a page, and the kernel would know where this page is by construction. And it would save the state to this page, the non-privileged state. But it would be perfectly okay if that page was actually mapped at some virtual address by the process. This is non-privileged state. It's okay for the process to muckle it from a protection standpoint. And so that's exactly what L4 does. When you create a task, a UPCB page comes with it. On some architectures, it's actually more than a page. Let's stick with a page for a minute. Same thing. We'll just make the page bigger if we need to. We'll use two. It's the same idea. And so, these now the kernel, by design, imposes the requirement that the UTCB is always validly mapped in the kernel. And what that means is, if I want to copy data from one UTCB to another UTCB, I can just do it with a string loop. I don't need to do any protection checks. It's always mapped. I always have the data structure. The kernel is hanging on to it. There's no way it's going to go away. The only way it can go away is if the task was destroyed, and we're going to guard against that. So this is the simple case where I can do a cross-process copy, where one process is saying, take this vector of words out of my UTCB, which are the virtual registers, right, and copy that vector to the other guy's UTCB. All the kernel has to do is reach into the other guy's task control block and say, great, I don't really care where you think the UTCB is mapped. I want to copy the registers to the kernel mapping for the UTCB. Right, it's a straight copy. And because we've guaranteed that the UTCB is mapped, there's no possibility of a page fault. There's no possibility of an exception. Right, we need to make sure that the user doesn't say, hey, copy 172 of my 32 virtual registers. That would be bad. Right, but all these other possible complications don't get in the way. Very simple operation. OK. Okay, the indirect string is a copy from the source address space to the destination address space. And the basic description of this string in its simplest form is, the sender says, here is a pointer that is an offset relative to the sender address space, and here's a length. The recipient, for their part, says, here is a pointer where I would accept a string, and here is a limit, a bound, on how much I will take. And after the transfer, the recipient is told how much they actually got, which might be shorter than they said they were willing to take. I could say, I'm willing to take 64 kilobytes, and you might only send 10 bytes. That's okay, but I need to know how much you sent. Conversely, I might say, hey, I'm willing to take 4 kilobytes, and you might try to send me 15 megabytes. And guess what? I didn't agree to take that. I'm going to get 4 kilobytes, and I'm going to get told that there was stuff that didn't get delivered because I wouldn't take it. There's a bound on the length of an indirect string. And this is generally true in all of, well, especially it's generally true in microkernels. It's not. It is true in all high-performance microkernels, and those are the only ones that still survive. The classic L4 bound on an indirect string is 4 megabytes. And in fact, and this is again sugar, in fact, the payload can include multiple indirect strings, and it can just gather together. These are not complications that it's terribly productive to dig into at this level. Why 4 megabytes? Well, now you're going to start to see the micro and microkernels. One of the things you lose in a microkernel is you don't tend to abstract the hardware very much. In fact, the goal is, in some sense, to expose as much of the full features of the hardware as you can, consistent with requirement for protection. You might canonicalize it. For example, different hardware or backend systems put protection bits in different detail in different places, but they all have read and write. Some of them have execute, and you might as well call the read and write of the interface. Right? There's no reason to expose the hardware data structure. You might canonicalize it a little bit. But ignoring this issue of sort of tweaking the canonicalization, you're basically exposing as much of the hardware feature set as you can. If you then want to build something that's a little more abstracted, great. Nobody's arguing you shouldn't do that. They're arguing it's not the microkernel's job. Keep it simple. And there's some, this is in much the way that there are debates between Protestants and Catholics about the meaning of Christianity. There are debates between microkernel authors about how much canonicalization is good for you and where's the right place to draw the line. And the truth is, none of them matter. They're mostly fine choices. It's all engineering trade-offs at that point. Okay. Why 4 megabytes? Well, 4 megabytes because the earliest protected processor that this particular system was done on was the 386. The 386, it turned out, mapping a 4 megabyte chunk was a very natural thing to do. Now, I'm telling a retrospective story about how this happened. It's very possible Johann had a more principled reason for choosing this number. Wouldn't surprise me he had principled reasons for many things that he did, but wouldn't surprise me also if this was driven by hardware and just later became frozen for reasons of history. You need a limit. If only because, in order to do this string copy, the kernel, right, it's going to copy from one space to another space. Unfortunately, the hardware does not allow it to do a read in one space and a write in another space at the same time. So what the kernel has to do is construct a temporary mapping. And what happens with this temporary mapping is, a long time ago, I drew a picture that said, here's the address space, and typically we're going to take a chunk at the top for the kernel. And I said that very often, that chunk is shared in the sense that if you were to look at two processes, they have identical kernel maps. In a high-performance microkernel implementation, we're going to finesse the story a little bit further. Okay, so the user stuff is going to be private, okay? But somewhere in this kernel virtual range, so it's accessible only to the kernel,
we're going to reserve a window, a region of the virtual address space where we can establish temporary mappings in the kernel in order to serve some operation done by this process. So here's how this works. I enter the kernel, I say, oh, you're sending a string on it. Boy, that's a pain in the ass. I reach over to the recipient hardware tables, MAC tables. I walk them in software to find the destination pages or to find what I need in order to establish a temporary mapping. And there's an optimization, which is how we got to 4 megabits. I actually copy those page table entries from the other guy's address space into the transient mapping region. Now they're valid in MySpace too. They're valid in the kernel portion of MySpace, not something the user code can get to. Right. What I've just done is I've created a temporary cross map onto a region of the recipient space.
Does that mean information shared this way can be seen by any application?
No. This region is private. Let me finish the story and then let me come back to that question. Now that I've created the temporary mapping, the catch is now I'm not the recipient said, here's the address I want, right? Well, I've created a temporary mapping. The temporary mapping is at a different address. It's a kernel address. It's in the kernel virtual region. So I now take the pointer that the user said, here's where I want to receive it, say, okay, but in my mapping, that same location is at this other address. It's the one I just put it at. And now I'm in the kernel and I'm doing this string copy, but now I'm doing the string copy in one space, because I'm doing it all in the sender's address space. Why is that possible? Because I've just established this temporary mapping in the sender space. So I go ahead and do the string copy. And when the string copy is done, I unmap the temporary mapping. So first, when the operation's done, this mapping is going to be gone. So it doesn't get contaminate from one operation to the next. And to answer your question, no, this window is per space, it's private. So the kernel code and data remain map shared, but this window remains per address space, even though it's within the kernel region. So it's accessible only to kernel, but even within that, it's accessible only to kernel on behalf of current process.
Wait, so you're saying that every application has its own transient map?
Every address space has its own transient region that is within the kernel reserved virtual address range.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. There's about a billion more details on how you do that efficiently, including what happens if a page fault occurs, and there are no pleasant answers to what happens if a page fault occurs. Do you have a question there? Is that a TV? It's,
yeah.
You can share, right? All right, now these mappings thing, right? This is the interesting part. Actually, if you're implementing it, the indirect string is the interesting part because it's such a pain in the neck. But the mappings part is the thing that makes sort of L4 what it is.
What do you mean indirect string?
Okay, I mean it's done as a copy between a from space and a to space.
Okay.
Now, in fact, that word transfer really is being done that way too, but the kernel is contriving to cheat in a way that guarantees that it doesn't have to build a temporary mapping and that no page fault can occur. The problem with these cross-space operations is I'm with the kernel doing a copy into a data structure that the user established. The user, one of the things the recipient could say, or the sender could say, hey, here's a so-long string, and by the way, in the middle of it, I'm not going to tell you this, there's a page missing. And when you go to copy it, you're going to take a fault. That fault is going to be taken by the kernel because the kernel is doing the copy. So the kernel has to guard against this. And that's why this is a tricky operation. So the thing that makes the indirect string interesting is you're hazarded by all kinds of possible exceptions that in the virtual register transfer case you can finesse by a prior arrangement.
So you're saying the indirect string is just a string that's being copied indirectly?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So it's this case where the kernel kind of has to reach up into one space and reach up into another space and temporarily build this incestuous and dangerous relationship so that a string copy can proceed, during which bad things may happen, like a page fault. All right, the mapping part is the interesting part. Yeah.
why can't you just have like a public region in that kernel space where you can have just have like a global pool of these strings so you avoid all of the string copies, you know what I mean?
I don't understand. How would I have a global pool of strings?
Well, you said that the kernel space persists from one address space to the other.
So now what I'm saying, in Unix that's true. What I'm saying now is that this region is shared.
Yeah. So take a little chunk out of that and dedicate it just to
the... No, that's exactly what I must not do.
Oh, you don't want to.
It's not that I'm moving some particular string whose value is known. Right? It's that I'm sending data to you. This data, its content is dynamically established. And the last thing you want to do is any sort of extra copy.
That would avoid any copies.
No, it wouldn't. Let me back up. Let's explain where this data is coming from. Okay. Ultimately, just above the IPC layer, there's a little C procedure. And this C procedure was something like write. Okay, and it had a few arguments, like write to some file descriptor at some offset for some length. Those are short arguments. They're going to end up in these virtual registers. Then there's the buffer. And that buffer could be arbitrarily large. That's the thing that's going as the indirect string. And in order to adopt the design you're talking about, what we would have to do first, we have to pre-allocate a large indirect region, 4 megabytes per process. That's a lot of memory. Second, the sending application would have to now copy that string into that region, drop it into the kernel, now it's mapped, we know it's good, and then the kernel would have to copy it back out into the destination region. One of the major advances in microkernels was figuring out how never to have to do that second copy. Turns out that second copy is a performance disaster. It's an overall 50% reduction in the performance of the machine to do that copy. Really impressive. Look, the way to think about this is, if we're going to speak sort of, you know, rigorously, the slowest thing on your machine is the disk drive, right? The reason your machine works is you never touch it. So when we're done with the disk drive, the slowest thing left on your machine is the memory. The fewer copies you do, the happier you're going to be.
This whole indirect string system, this is exposed to the user as a message sending email?
Yes, that's exactly what we're talking about here. We're talking about what is the... From the transport layer's point of view, what is the payload of a message? That's what we're talking about here. Okay. Now the mapping part's interesting. Did that answer your question about?
Yeah, but, okay, let's say we have this global on the kernel, right? So now we request this indirect string area.
Good, what happens when the kernel runs out? You're pursuing a reasonable question. There's two problems with the question with the answer. The first is, in order to really evaluate this notional design, first we have to actually capture what it is, of course. And then we have to ask, well, how many interactions are there going to have to be between the application and the kernel in order to set up a message? Each of those costs 1,000 cycles on a modern machine. But also, what new possible failure modes are we going to introduce that we're then going to have to introduce support code to deal with, or at least to defer to somebody else? So there's cascading complexity in any design choice you make. The second thing, and without doing a little more of the literature, you have no reason to know this, is it turns out that design is based on control. And it turns out it's not very pretty. There is a middle point, which is, so one way to look at that is, boy, I didn't want to have to do this kind of resource allocation. In that particular design that you're thinking about, the place I'm going to get caught is in the kernel managing and unmanaging all these buffers. But there's another possible position, which is to say, suppose I say, every application has a 4K data region, it's pre-reserved, it lives in the kernel, it's known to the kernel, at a prior address, and we're just not going to do big string transfers. Right? We're going to do only up to 4K. You want to send more than that? Send twice. Vast majority of messages don't send a string at all. And although it's counterintuitive, it turns out somewhere around 4K or 8K, in fact, to be specific, at exactly half the size of the level 1 data cache, it's actually faster to send a message
a long string as multiple messages, and it has to do with caching conflict. So that's not a crazy design, and as long as that region can be kept small enough, it's a viable design. The penalty for that cost is the double copy, and it doesn't appear to be a good way to avoid them. One thing you could do, and this is an interesting possibility, is you could say, well, wait a minute, maybe I really could avoid double copy. Here's one thing I could do. In the source, copy the message to this holding page. Drop it to the kernel. Instead of then copying the message out to the destination user space, exchange the pages, right? So now I'm doing a page flip. So what it means to send a message is the receiver and the sender are going to swap pages. There are some problems with this. I just got back a page that contains the content of the last message you received. So that page needs to be zeroed for security reasons. It's actually a challenge. Second issue, the recipient is now going to have to copy the data that just came in into a reasonably safe location. By the way, since they're going to do that copy, we could say, look, if the recipient wants the data private while they're doing the copy, they should zero it. They're touching all the data anyway. That's a good time to do it. That would not be crazy. Test question. What's the likelihood that this recipient-initiated copy was already necessary anyway? If they were going to have to unpack the data in any case, this copy is an unavoidable copy. We're only debating where to do it from. So in some cases, it depends on what the message was. So in the case where the message was, you know, some record structure with some pointers that you serialize into a byte string, right, and then when the recipient gets it in, they're going to unpack it back into its pointer form, yes, they're going to unpack the data structure anyway. Fine. At that point, you're doing a copy, and this page flipping trick is a great idea. And there are systems like Xen that use a very similar trick for their virtualized networking architecture. It's a very nice trick. And it works depending on what the assumptions about the usage patterns are. The other possibility, however, is if only you had put the data in the right place in the first place, it wouldn't be moving again. And unfortunately, it turns out the vast majority of things that actually use an indirect payload are things like the thing that's implementing the file system. And in the file system case, it turns out, the file system is in a very good position at the time that it says, I'm going to receive a message, saying, by the way, if that message is a write, here's the buffer to put it in, and that's actually the buffer I'm going to leave the data in. It's going exactly to the right place. Now, in that case, the page flipping trick is going to push you into an extra data move that's actually a problem. And there are further things that you might contemplate to augment that, and it is possible to build a protocol on that. It's not trivial, it needs careful thought. It might be a good thing to do. Definitely worth thinking about. And there's at least one system that tried this particular approach that I'm sketching now, and it did in fact work fairly well. Their implementation had some security holes. What's not known is whether those security holes could be closed without a severe performance penalty. If you ignore the security issues, it worked very well. My view is blatant security holes are just a bug. They're a categorically unacceptable design, but that has to do with the kinds of systems I'm interested in designing. And it may not be so important for other kinds of systems. Although, one has to be careful to say that, because today's minor annoyances are tomorrow's major problems.
I understand why there has to be a page swap. Why can't there just be a page move?
Because that's exactly the copy we're trying to avoid. So the page swap is simply to pick up the respective page. Excuse me. The page swap is to pick up the respective page table entries and simply exchange them.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing.
Why don't you just take the page table entry, remove it from one address space, and assign it to the other address?
Because then we lost. Okay. So the question is, why are we doing an exchange of pages? Why not just do a donation of pages? Because then we've lost conservation of storage. So now what happens is, every time I want to send you a message, right, I have to pay the ferryman in front of hell. And I don't get my money back unless you later agree to give up the page. This is a page I paid for, and I'm not getting anything back. And now what happens is, I've got storage that's allocated that you're holding captive.
because I donated those pages to you. I don't have them anymore. I can't even destroy them, because if I destroy them, I will have unpredictable impact on your execution. You might be accessing those pages as I destroy them. I don't actually need to get back a page per se. I do need to get back the right to allocate a page, because I don't want to end up at a net loss in the transaction. I want to end up at a net break even. Problem with getting back the right to allocate a page is that in order to actually allocate that page, I'm now going to have to do an interprocess call. Then we're going to have a reductio problem. Because in order to do that interprocess call, it might be possible to design that one so it doesn't require an indirect string. But if it does, now I'm going to have to do a page exchange with the guy I'm calling for the purpose of getting another page. That's the reductio problem. In fact, we can probably double that. Okay? But the right to allocate is a much more expensive resource than actually having a page. So the exchange keeps us in a situation where both sides are break even on the transaction with regard to payment for resource.
But if the...
If there's a question here, let's get on that table. You're on to a good issue here.
Okay.
So I should explain that we've actually done this page flipping trick. It's a sleazy trick for doing an implementation of byte copy. What we've actually done inside the kernel, logically, is we've, in each case, copied the data to the other page. But we've done it by rebinding the identities in the pages inside the kernel. Which may or may not be faster, depending on the TLB architecture. That's an interesting problem. Also depends on how much payload you want to send. So in the case of the Zen networking subsystem, one of the optimizations that they missed the first time through, hey, if I'm doing a large Ethernet packet, this page flip looks really good. Turns out there are a lot of small Ethernet packets in the world. If I'm only moving 64 bytes, the right thing to do is copy them. Don't do the page flip. Because the page flip involves whacking a TLB entry. Whacking a TLB entry involves a several hundred cycle cost as the TLB gets rebuilt on some architecture. So there's a thresholding decision about when to switch strategies, but this is all fine details for implementation. I don't want to trivialize them, because getting these fine details right is what makes the difference between a viable microkernel implementation today and not. But what I want to try to focus on today is sort of the idea of what the microkernel is surfacing. Let me get to that, because that's the thing that makes L4 L4. In L4, at the start of the world, every page in the system lives in an initial address space. This address space is referred to as sigma zero, sigma for space. Whatever the virtual address size of your machine is, that's the size of sigma zero. And however much physical memory you have, right, there's some threshold where you run out of physical memory. But up to that limit, that's the definition of the initial mapping of sigma zero. So the world starts with a single virtual address space that's a one-to-one map on the physical memory. Notice this doesn't work on some architectures. There's a little problem with the Pentium that the virtual address space is 4 gigabytes. But the physical address space is potentially 64 gigabytes. That can be a little awkward. There are ways to generalize this to say, well, we don't have to be limited by the hardware-defined virtual address space. But let me stick with that, and let me just ignore that issue. I wanted to point out the issues there and then solve them. What are the arguments to the map operation? So actually, when I see mappings here, technically, what the specification has is some number of what are called map items. What I want to do is say, what's the description of a map item? A map item is an address and a number k, which is
So every map item transfers to the K pages for sub K. So it's got to be a power of 2. And this address is the term that she used is it's congruent mod to the k times the page size. That's a fancy way of saying it's naturally aligned. So if I'm sending you 4 kilobytes of pages, I have to send it at an address that's a multiple of 4 kilobytes. So when you see this terminology, what that means is if you take this mod, this address, and you take it modulo that thing on the right, you'll get 0. Another way to say this is the k lowest bits of this address are 0. Careful, because this k was expressed in terms of pages, and strictly speaking, it's only k lowest bits if we do it in terms of bytes. And I think if we were to look at the map item specification, I believe we might discover that it actually is expressed in terms of bytes, but with the restriction that the smallest unit you can ship is a page. That would end up with pretty much the same implementation, but it would be compatible across multiple hardware systems because you might have different page sizes, but the size of a byte doesn't change. This is what the sender says. The recipient specifies the dual of this. What the recipient says is, here's a hole. It's a hole at a particular address, and that hole is at least big enough to hold this thing you're going to send me. If it's not, the map will fail. You can't take a big thing and squeeze it into a little thing. But I can send you a 16-page region, and if you have a 32K hole, that's just fine. If you have a 16K hole, it's just fine. If you have an 8K hole, the map will fit. It won't fit. 10 pounds of you-know-what into a 5-pound sack. So the idea here is to imagine that from the software, from the architectural point of view, the system defines an address space as a binary tree of pages. Right? The pages are at the leaves, and the logical model of the architecture is that the software-defined mapping structure, this is not the implementation, it's just the model. Software-defined mapping structure is a binary tree. So what this map item actually names is a particular node somewhere in the binary tree. It is the node that ends up getting shared. And in fact, the implementation will efficiently copy page table entries. So it turns out that binary tree has a projection on the actual hardware tables, and the implementation is very good at maintaining it. Now there's more to the story. Question?
Basically, does the kernel think of the address space as a heap implemented in a vector?
No. The kernel logically. I don't want to talk about how the kernel thinks about it because there are about 17 implementations of this, and I don't want to get pinned down on one. Partly because all of them are good and all of them are weak in some respect. The model is that we're establishing a sharing point in the mapping structures. The actual implementation, of course, is limited by what's available on the hardware. But I also want to clarify, this map item does not mean that I have 2 to the k valid pages at that address. What this means is any mappings that I do have are going to end up shared, including any invalid mappings that I have. So there's no validity check in this. So if I have a 16-page region and only 3 pages are defined, you're going to get a 16-page region in which only 3 pages are defined. Some fine print. What happens, we do this the first time, you've got a hole. Now we do it again, and you're accepting into the same location, but now your hole's occupied, because it's occupied by whatever went there last time. What happens? Well, first we're going to unmap the old stuff. Then we're going to map the new stuff. Right, so it's a replacing operation. It's not a commingling operation. And I've left out one important detail, which is the reason I'm bringing up that picture. So I said that the result is that we share a subtree. And in the L4 definition of the map operation, that's actually not the case. Not quite. The definition of the map operation is that after I map a region to you, I am entitled to unmap it. I can take it back. Okay. So what actually happens is that I start off with a tree, and somewhere in this tree there's an element that I map to you, right? That's what they call a flex page, one of these naturally aligned to the K page regions. Here's your tree. And in order to accept that mapping, you have to have a hole of the right size or bigger in an appropriate location. Fine. You don't actually end up, so I made it sound like you're going to end up basically with this pointer redirected over to my dot. That's not what happens. There's no sharing here in that sense. What actually happens is you end up with a new dot that's a copy of one. This is really weird, because if it were actual sharing, suppose we started in that situation where I had 16 pages, only three of which were defined, and we actually really identically shared the structure. Well, if I later defined a fourth page, it would now be good for you too. That is not what happens here. This is a copy of mapping structure. So you end up with a tree that is a lazy copy of my mapping data. And what the unmap operation does is it shoots your copy. So after I map to you, you get a mapping, I can say, unmap the thing that I mapped before. In fact, I can't even say unmap it from you. I can say, this region here, anybody I've ever mapped it to, unmap it from all of them. So you have to view as recipient that any mapping you receive is a contingent mapping. Its durability is subject to the continuing goodwill and correct execution of the party who sends it to you. That turns out to be a non-trivial design constraint when you're trying to build robust applications. And you'll end up in situations trying to do that where you'll get a message from me, but you don't want to be subject to my failure. And so you will have to arrange through a mutually trusted third party to get a mapping that is independent of the one that I gave you of the same stuff. And that turns out to be complicated. Now, what I want to point out is that what started in the L4 model as a way of transferring mappings on pages evolved. Ignoring the fact that what we were trying to map was pages and there was hardware support for it, there's nothing in the notion of a hierarchical mapping structure that is specific to pages. It's a mapping from offsets to things. When we're talking about paging and address spaces, the things are pages. But there are other things that we might reasonably put in a tree structure. This operation is well defined on any tree structure. It doesn't matter what it leaves. So historically, this was introduced for purposes of managing page wrappings, thus the term flex page for these map models. But there are other address spaces that we might use to do this. So for example, notice that this task vector is actually an address space. It's a space of tasks. It has an offset. Each task has an offset. we could introduce a different kind of map item that would map subregions of the task space. It wouldn't map them into your page address space, but we could introduce the notion of a task address space and map things between them. In fact, we can do this for any resource in the system. Very general model. It only requires that we stop getting trapped in the notion that an address space has to do with pages. An address space is just a mapping from offsets to things. And they're doing that. In fact, one of the major changes, the big change, in L4SEC, which is the allegedly secure successor to L4, is that a lot of other kernel resources now have spaces and can be mapped in this fashion. So it used to be that in the current L4, when you say, I want to send a message from task I, I'm task I, and I want to send a message to task J, the J that you would give would be the actual index into the kernel task table. It's not a protected thing, it's just another. What that means is anybody can send a message to anybody, and it's up to the recipient to reject it. I'm ignoring a feature they have called plans and chiefs, which can implement filtering, but it's now generally agreed that that filtering had prohibitive cost. But suppose I were to reinterpret that number to say, well, that destination task number is a number relative to my task address space. And in order for that number to be meaningful, somebody has to have mapped to me that task. Now we have a protected IPC system. We're just going to reuse the memory mapping style of protection. And this time we're going to apply it to task names. And then just to close the conversation out, grant is a map in which I'm handing to you everything I've got and I'm giving it up. So grant is actually a move of a tree. I'm giving it up in the same step where I transfer to you. I can't unmap after a grant. Grant is a migration. And grant turns out to be used very rarely, and they're considering removing it from the architecture. The sort of, if you were to ask the L4 people, what's the defining operation of their system architecturally is the snap-on-map pair of operations. Okay, I want to point out a hidden consequence of unmap, and then I want to declare victory for the day. Suppose I have a chain of processes A, B, C, D. Each of these processes maps a data region to the next one, right? They're forming a bucket for data. So B and C are acting basically as part of some kind of a transport. Now ultimately what's going on is D is ending up with a space that originates in. The continued durability of that mapping seen by D not only depends on the continuing behavior of A, it also depends on the continuing behavior of B and C. Because anybody who has performed a map can't unmap anybody who is downstream from them in the sequence of mappings. Because unmap is recursive, right? If I have mapped to you, and you have mapped to him, and I unmap from you, he loses his rights to it.
Is this done? Recursion check done at the time of unmap, or is D actually mapped into C, and then C is mapped into D, and B is mapped into A, and therefore it's an actual requirement?
The maps went the other way.
I'm sorry. If A is mapped into B, and B is mapped into C, etc.
So at the time of the map, the kernel actually allocates a data structure that exists for the sole purpose of later supporting the unmap operation. And that's the other hidden consequence of this, is that each of these map operations entails a storage allocation that's hidden and not accounted for. There are stories, I've heard variations of stories about how one might think about accounting for that allocation. I don't believe any of them are clean, although it's very possible I haven't understood the story correctly.
You're feeling with the guy in
Now, I want you to contrast this story, though,
with what happens in a network packet. Right? One guy ships a packet of bytes on a network. A packet goes across 5 billion routers, and it gets to me. And I pick up the network packet. Now, hey, the packet may have been compromised. I don't know if it's valid until I do some kind of external check on it. Signature check or something. But once I establish that I've got a valid byte sequence, I know two things. One, I don't have to trust the routers in the middle. I can validate independent of whether the routers in the middle are trustworthy. They might drop the message, so there are various ways that they can interfere with me, but assuming I get a message, I can check for compromise, and if I establish the compromise has not occurred, I have no further dependency with respect to that message on the continued good behavior of the routers in the middle. And I have no further dependency on the continued behavior of the sender. The message is now good in its own right after validation. Now, we have to establish a way to validate, and that's an important detail. This forms a separation of concerns. It is important in order to allow me to establish a separation of failure domains. Because it means once I check that message, the sender can crash. And if I fail, it's because I did something wrong, not because the sender did something wrong. I mean, if we're in the middle of a session, there's more stuff coming that I've got to have, yeah, the session will get cut off, I'll have to back it out, okay? But the point is, whatever data I have that is complete in some sense is now isolated from the failure of anybody else, also from their misbehavior. That is not true in the network. The workaround is, instead of sending me a map, right, if we establish, yes, we're going to need to establish this sort of independence, what A does instead is says, here's the thing that I would have sent you, except that if I had sent it that way, we'd have ended up in this dependency problem. So what I'm going to send you instead is authority to go to the originator and get a mapping that's independent of these monkeys in the middle. So now, I'm going to draw the picture upside down, okay? You have an object server. This object server is the originator of this object. This is where A got it from, right? So A does, the object server does a map to A. A essentially hands off an authentication token down the pipeline. And D now does a round trip back to the object server to get a mapping that is not hazarded by failure or misbehavior by B and C or even A. In my opinion, the fundamental problem with this design, this was the behavior you wanted as the normal case. You don't want to have to do extra work to get isolation of failure domains. Now, I have to acknowledge that is a theological difference in opinion between the L4 set group and our group here. It is, in fact, the thing that prevented these two architectures from merging. And I can say that we've got 30 years of experience backing up the view that if you have to default the other way, you get good outcomes. That doesn't mean this is a bad outcome, but it does appear to me to be an expensive outcome, and it depends on how paranoid your design is. In this system, paranoid defensible designs are harder to build. All right, let's come back to this tomorrow.